Thanks for joining the Senior Man Podcast show on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. I have the honor of being your host. My name is Jeff Rothmeyer, member of the St. Paul Fire Department, currently honored to be the captain of Engine 17. Today, we will be joined shortly by Jeff Shoup and Bob Pressler, our senior men who will help us fill the mortar of our fire service knowledge. A quick note on our inaugural show. The format of the show has us reviewing fire service literature. We will be reading sections deemed pertinent by me, the host, and then allow our senior men to fill in the gaps and comment on relevant items to enhance firefighter knowledge. Our mission is to enhance this firefighter knowledge for the citizens' benefit. The format is influenced by a non-fire service podcast called Jocko Podcast. If you haven't listened to this leadership-specific show, I highly recommend it at jockopodcast.com. I want to thank Fire Engineering for giving us the ability to engage the fire service through this medium. We are motivated to get to work. If you enjoy the show and want to engage with us on your time, follow us on Facebook. You can find us at The Senior Man on Facebook. Let us know what you think. So, without further ado, let's get started. Gentlemen, roll call. For the engine manning the nozzle tonight, Shoop. Shoop, you out there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here. Okay, yes, sir.
Jeff,
Okay.
you want to give us a quick background for our audience?
Yeah, I guess I can think of something to say about myself. So I just don't want to get too deep into it. But anyways, I started the job in '74 and retired in 2011. Took a officer's job in another fire department for a short time, and then I came home after about a year and a half, and been doing things like this, fire training and so forth with fire departments all over, doing some stuff with a nozzle manufacturer like Elkhart Brass with the brass tack stuff. I'm one of those guys who enjoyed being a firefighter. I didn't need anybody telling me, I had to have a good attitude. I'd like to say that I believed I always held the fire service in high esteem and, wanted to learn about it, do it, and so forth. So, anyways, I'll cut it off there. Okay. So,
Thanks,
Bob,
Jeff.
or you introduce Bob. Go
Yes,
on.
for the truck manning the irons tonight, we've got Bob Pressler. Bob, a quick background for the audience, please.
Been in the fire service for about 45 years, which makes me old. Have been in a bunch of different departments, including New York City for 19 years. Currently active in the Montgomery, New York Volunteer Fire Department as a firefighter and a captain in the Christiana Fire Department in Delaware as a captain.
Excellent.
Enough, let's go.
All right, Bob.
I
Jeff, Bob,
wish I could have said mine that quick.
Well, I think the audience are well aware of, at least that are probably tuning into this show are well aware of who you guys are, but just wanted to give a little context in case there wasn't anybody out there, if there is anybody out there who wasn't. So, just a little bit more on the format. Jeff's going to be answering a lot of our engine specific content, and then Bob will be pertaining to the truck, obviously, and maybe rescue activities. So that's kind of the format tonight, and we'll start rolling with it. So the book that we're going to be referencing tonight is Fire Ground Tactics by Emmanuel Freed. Chief Freed was with the FDNY for several years, and as I started going down my path of fire service knowledge, I ran into this book actually recommended by Jeff Shoup there, and found a lot of pertinent information that wasn't in any of my educational background. And so that's the goal of this show, obviously, is to start finding those past nuggets that aren't reaching our current firefighters. So we'll jump right in. First, we'll start off with some strategy and fire tactics. And we'll see what Chief Freed has to say on ventilation here. So, in our intro, Chief Freed references firefighting has a dual objective: saving lives and conserving property. To accomplish this objective as efficiently as possible, a sequence of operational practice has been developed over the years. An analysis of passing contemporary techniques shows that the operation generally follows this pattern: pre-fire planning, fire ground size up, and then the firefighting steps as ventilation, operation of hose streams, overhauling, and then finally post-fire analysis and study. What I found interesting here, leaving the book for a second, is that ventilation was listed ahead of operation of hose streams in Chief Freed's analysis of firefighting steps. So just a quick ad lib on this one. Why would Chief Freed mention ventilation over operation of hose streams? And I'll direct that question to Bob.
Well, I think when you're looking at Chief Freed, you have to look at where he came from. So in New York City, when you get three engines and two trucks on an initial alarm with that many firefighters, ventilation becomes one of the first things we do because of the amount of people on the fire ground. I think a lot of times when you read these books, we have to be able to adapt what is said in the book to our people. If I'm rolling up with only two engines to start because I'm a small department, ventilation isn't at the top of my game. What I want to do is I want to get a hand line in service. So I know the way he listed it, and I'm sure he had his reasons back then. But when you look at our modern fire ground, and pretty much this has been what I've gone by since I've been a firefighter, nothing should deter the first hand line from getting in service. And you can actually look at some terrible fires that have happened where the good intentions of firefighters to try to make rescues where they've neglected getting a line in service have had some terrible consequences. Keokuk, Iowa is the example that I always use when I'm speaking to groups of people about this. Four kids trapped in a building. They grab one, they go to the hospital with one, remaining firefighters, everyone searching for the victims. No one brought a hand line to the fight. The pump operator saw what was going on. She stretched a line to the front door, ran back to charge it, and by the time she got water in the line, it was too late. So ventilation is important. It's one of the steps that we need to have in our plan of how we're going to operate. But getting the hose line in operation is the most important thing we do on the fire ground. And it's interesting, and just recently I've had some talks around one of the kitchen tables that I frequent, and they were talking about pulling up as that first two engine officer with, you know, reported people trapped. And it was kind of amazing how many officers were forgoing getting the line in operation in order to do the rescue. And that will be a terrible decision to have to make, but in my world, someone's still going to get water on the fire. Because without that, we're setting ourselves up for failure.
Sure. Okay. Well, and that might be, again, it sounds like it's a dynamic situation. And in maybe Chief Freed's day, the resources and some of the technology prevented maybe getting a line in service as quickly as ventilating, being that, you know, as I read through the book, a lot of these operations said you may need to get a mask or an SCBA in service on this type of a fire, meaning that obviously in his day they weren't wearing SCBAs, and so now ventilation took on a whole new meaning, which we don't really understand because it hasn't been a part of my world, I guess, as from my start in the fire service 12 years ago. So all right, well, we'll move.
The other thing you have to keep in mind is we haven't defined what kind of fire he was talking about.
Sure.
And he doesn't either, so it's open for interpretation. But if I have a fire in the kitchen of a 2.5-story frame house with people upstairs, getting water on the kitchen fire is the best thing I can do to give my people access to the people upstairs. If I pull up and I have a 2-story commercial building where we're having trouble finding the sidewalk, then ventilation's probably going to go pretty far up on that list because I can't get a hose line into operation until we get some kind of relief and find it, whether it be the front windows of the stores, whether it be topside ventilation. My first multiple alarm fire in New York City 1,000 years ago was a fourth alarm on Flatbush and Church, where you couldn't see Flatbush Avenue. And continually opening stores and breaking windows, finally the third store that was picked turned out to be the fire store. That's how bad conditions were in the street. So no water was flowing. Ventilation took priority because we couldn't find the fire. So that's another factor that gets played in there. But in this case, the ventilation was to get a line on the fire. So we do different things. We force doors, we ventilate, we have to get access for the line. But, you know, we have to remember that that ventilation is venting for fire, not venting for life.
I see. So it's a dynamic decision. It's a dynamic process. So then that was going to be my next question, Bob. So I appreciate you answering that, is when does ventilation start getting a priority or taking a priority to water? And that's when we can't get the water to the fire based on conditions. And so now we have to start making the structure act in the way we want it to, so that we can get that hand line onto the fire.
Yeah, Tom Brennan used to say that all the time. We need to control the fire building before it controls us. You know, so we've gone from a period where we broke every window in the building to we didn't break any. Then we put a fan up. Then we broke windows again. Now we're hanging curtains. You know, all these things are great, but what we have to do is learn to control the building before it controls it for us. You know, there's too many instances on the fire ground. I saw another one last night on the internet. I saw another one last night scrolling through some photographs where an engine company is bogged down at the front door because the stuff boiling out the front door is almost down to the sill level, and adjacent to the front door are three big windows. Well, if the engine can't get in the front door, that's a problem. So get the glass, open the place up. You know, they can see the fire was in the CD corner. Well, get the place open up so the company can make the push. If they can't get up off the step, and I'm sure Jeff will back me up on this, if they can't get up off the front step, they're not going to get too far. Well, it's not the GPMs right now. It's the act to get the water closer to the fire.
Jeff, you got any comments on that?
Yeah. I go along with everything that Bob has said, because going back to that original thing about Freed, you know, exactly right. Define what the fire is that he's talking about when he talks about ventilation taking a priority over a fire. You know, most fire departments out there today are not dealing with 4, 5, or 6-story tenements of any age or anything like that. The other thing is the manpower situation. Bob, that thing about the engine, you've got to get the line out. You know, most fires that we're going to go to, where ventilation especially and life safety might be involved, are residential type structures or multiples or mixed multiples or something like that. You've got to get the line out. You know, we tell people, drill on this back home about getting the line out of the bed 90 seconds or less to water to the tip and things like that. Why would we drill on that and not do it at a fire? And you're absolutely right. We have this thing nowadays where guys want to say, oh, it's a 3-man engine, and this is what we can do, and this is what we have to do. No. Fire is burning, and mostly a wood frame structure most of the time. We need water to put the fire out, to control the situation and things like that, and make everybody, including ourselves, safer. Why would you want to basically commit yourself or sacrifice yourself in a situation? And it's not in the name of being brave or anything like that. It's in the name of doing the right thing and the priority order and so forth. So get that line out of that bed and charged is it.
So a quick question on this topic for both of you, and trying to make it a little bit brief, but do you guys believe that the fire service is timid when it comes to ventilation these days?
Is what?
Timid to ventilation?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think they're more confused than timid.
Okay.
We went putting fans on the front door to saying now no ventilation. You know, so how can we keep up and around? If every 15 years, you know, we have a new thing that comes in and we change all our procedures. We used to get the bulkhead in New York City 100% of the time. Now they've decided that we can't get the bulkhead. And the scariest part about that is none of the live fire training or none of the UL NIST studies that I've seen have ever burned in a five-story oval tenement. And if you can't get the staircase open, it will bank down. It'll put people on the upper floors in peril. And, you know, so here's a whole-scale change in operations based on 17 fires in 8 townhouses. And, again, not one of them was in an 8-type apartment house. A friend of mine went to a fire, it's about 9 months ago now, nice top-floor fire. They stopped on the floor below the 4th floor to mask up to make their push up to the top floor. By the time the special units, the rescue company got there, they had a mask up in the lobby. And no one's saying, listen, that ain't right. Instead of releasing it to the sky, let's just let it bank down all the way to the first floor of the building. It's stupid and it's dangerous. So we're going through one of these recycling periods where someone said we should try this. People have jumped on board and they refuse to listen to it, that it's not working. And that's what makes it dangerous.
Let me add to this. You're an engine company, as Bob's talking about. Him and I did talk about this the other night. You know, when you're an engine company and you can't move it, you're committed to the interior of this building and so forth, and you can't move, you can't get off the floor. There's a problem there. And I know of an incident where the guys are screaming for ventilation. The line is in, zero visibility, heavy heat down to the floor. Fire's belching out of 3 sides of this place, and ventilation, you get fire showing, and they're screaming for ventilation. Well, something's wrong here, you know. That's a fire assessment, that volume of fire and things like that. But the thing about, you know, we're now timid about ventilation because we got guys running around the country screaming about, you know, lightweight construction and this is what you got to watch for, stay off the roofs. Well, how are you going to get vertical ventilation taking place, get that crap off of us and off the people when you're telling your fire forces, oh, it's going to be a defensive fire. Oh, we're right off the building. Oh, it's in the Conklin. Oh, it's a, you know, soft roof or whatever, you know. It's just not working. The other thing is the engines. When you're in that situation, you start throwing the water. When you're pinned to the floor and ventilation isn't taking place or isn't effective, you start throwing water. If it's that hot that you can't move, you know. I give people the analogy, if there was a sprinkler 8 feet over your head, what would it be doing? So this is how you protect yourself if there's no ventilation taking place or it's not being effective. So I think it's a two-pronged attack there.
Excellent. Coordinated fire attack. We'll keep trucking. All right, so back to Chief Freed. Chief Reed states in another study shows that all of the alarms we respond to, 75% of the fires are out on arrival or easily extinguished by booster lines, but that less than 2% of the fires cause most of the loss of life and 70% of the damage. Less than half of 1% of the fires produce losses or more than 10,000, but this half of 1% causes 25% of our fire loss. Municipal Fire Administration says that firefighting involves a large number of fires which are relatively simple to handle and a few fires which involve many complex factors. Some are complex because they are large and some because they involve hazardous processes, materials, or both. As a result, our fire departments usually are proficient in handling simple fires but weak in handling complex ones. The plain fact is that we do not have enough large fires to develop through experience sufficient proficiency to handle the more serious fires. So, my question being to Bob, do you believe the fire service is ill prepared for large fires and perform in a reactionary mode at these events?
Absolutely, but I also feel that many places haven't solved the simple fires yet. Look at church fires. What's the American Fire Service track record in large church fires? We've got to be batting about, I don't know, 25%, you know, where we have a shot and 5% success. You know, there's some buildings that are meant to burn that there's not a lot we can do about it. My bigger concern is, because the big fires are going to be big fires. You know, there's too many places that will never get the staffing or be able to throw the manpower out at the right equipment, water supply. I mean, the big fires are going to be big fires for a reason. The ones that I get upset about, or I think we need to focus more on, are the simple ones. You know, the bedroom fires, the kitchen fires, and everybody goes, oh, you know, well, we're firemen. We can go put those things out. Listen, the internet is a beautiful thing. It exposes weaknesses on a daily basis. You can go watch a one-room fire burn down a house level with the ground. There is a lot of different dynamics in the American Fire Service today, and unfortunately, a lot of them are questioning tried-and-true tactics, and our officers, the company officers, where I think is the weakest part of our whole existence, are getting mixed signals.
Oh, absolutely. You know, oh, my God.
Should I hit it from there? Should I hit it from here? Should I hit it from there? I mean,
right.
It's so confusing. You know, there's a couple of videos out there that everybody's been using and bad-mouthing about hitting it hard from the yard. It's always been a tactic, but should it be my go-to tactic? So the big fires, you know what? They're going to be big fires. I want to get the people saved. I want to put out the ones that we should be able to put out first. And to me, that's where we're still kind of weak.
And wouldn't you agree? So I almost liken this to, say a football season. If you're good at handling your games throughout the regular season, and maybe even putting away your lesser opponents with more authority, would that mean that you, by nature, are going to be playing better in the big game? In the Super Bowl, you're probably going to perform better at the Super Bowl because you've handled business on the routine games or maybe even the easier ones?
Well, I think it's more focused on the basics. Everybody wants to be able to do everything, but guess what? We don't. Now, I've been doing this a long time, and still the stuff that I learned 40 years ago is what I still use today, and I do it unconsciously, and that's the part you have to get to. You know, I told the story to a couple guys last week. I had gone to a fire, ended up being the nozzleman, stretched to the side with mobile home, one going on one block, one going on the other block. And so I stretch, get in position, and while I get dressed, I could see my officer getting down the side of the trailer, trying to do a 360 as best as he can. I'm looking in the front door. I can see there's a couch across the front door. They tried to block us from getting in. I could look around the couch, see the fire coming down the hallway. And when I was done doing my assessment, I was dressed. I didn't think about putting my mask on or pulling my hood up or getting my gloves on. It happened while I was doing other things. And the point of that is, if you have to concentrate on the act of getting your gear on, you're missing something. You know, and I had it on right. I didn't get burned. I had breathing air. So I guess I got dressed correctly. And that's just one more of those steps. I teach with a captain out at the Fire Department Training Network, Mike Kirby from Cincinnati. And he does a thing with his company, and I'm stealing a little bit of Jeff's thunder here. But they pull up in front of a building, and from the time they set the parking brake to the line is on the front porch, bled, everybody dressed and ready to go, I believe he said his company's best time was 44 seconds. And that's not running. That's doing your job proficiently. That's getting line in service. And we'll never know how many buildings won't fall down on that engine company. We won't know how many people's lives are saved or how many firefighters don't get in trouble because they were able to get the line in service in under a minute instead of 3 minutes.
Right.
Proper application of water to the seat of the fire might keep a building from falling down an hour later. We'll never know, but what we do know is getting water on the fire in a minute is a heck of a lot better than getting water on the fire in 5 minutes.
Right.
And so if I can – well, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I want to go back here. What you read, that passage from Freed, and that was in 1972 that he was talking about the lack of experience. You know, all you got to do is look at the statistics for fires, you know, like when the NFPA started putting structural fire numbers together and numbers nationwide, you know, in the mid-70s. And we have seen, and you know, there's going to be a couple of guys out there that disagree with us, you know, or with this assessment, but nevertheless, the Flyers are going down. Okay, they're as I used to tell the guys back home once in a while, says, you know, the Flyers are a fraction of what they used to be. So it goes back to what we what Bob mentioned about the company officers, you know, and the calls that they make. They are confused because, look, what I have learned over my time, firefighting is circumstantial. All this stuff that's going around right now, you hit it right in the head, Bob. We're confusing people rather than teaching them principles and practices. And to me, this is what this job is about. You know, you go deep into the Freed's book here. 1972 was copyrighted and published, and he talks about firefighting being an art, being a technique, not a science. And he backs it up with what he states there. And I'm going to throw out another author, who is William Clark, you know, one of his proteges back then. You know, he says the same thing in his book. So as a fire officer, you know, especially nowadays, you know, he's confused about where to lay the hose line, you know, what to do in this case and so forth. And it leads to, shall I say, fickleness on the fire ground, you know, or changeability and so forth. Oh, look over here and so forth. The other thing is, I wanted to mention, firefighting being circumstantial, but we have changed. He mentioned booster lines in there, okay? Most fires were put out with booster lines. Look, nobody's doing booster lines that I come across. And practically all the fire departments that I've done training work with and so forth out there have graduated to 1¾-inch lines. We see guys out there now who I don't know what their goal is, but experience gained over time should tell you, you take as much water in with that hose line as you possibly can, because that's your safety, that's your efficiency. Going back to what we just said about ventilation, if your ventilation isn't effective, you want as much water in there with you as you possibly can take, because that's your safety at that point. Okay, so if your protective gear, and I'm piggybacking on you, Bob, here, I hope you don't mind, you know, but this thing about protective gear, you know, that's a process where we have failed in the basic training academies. You know, I heard Bob say out in Portland, we were out there a couple of weeks ago, don't run the fire ground, but walk with a sense of purpose. I think I'm right there, right? What you said.
Okay.
And that is so telling. Walk with a sense of purpose, you know, do your work. But this thing about, oh, we have to stop, we have to evaluate this, and we have to evaluate that, we got to run around the building 3 or 4 times, and, you know, this thing's working away, and then I've got to make sure this is in place, that's in place, and so forth. And then we're confused about where to place the hose line. If we get it out of the engine first, if we don't take our Halligan and run up and try to beat the building out, you know, there's just a lot of things. We've gotten away from principles and practices and the basics of the job in many instances. That thing about circumstantial situations, you know, I'm gonna step out here. This thing about somebody sitting in a big warehouse and lighting some boxes on fire and saying, oh, this is what we did, this is what we found. It's in Freed's book, okay, and it's all about circumstances. You can't say one size fits all for firefighting. Okay, now I'm gonna cut it there. Back to you, Jeff.
No, it's great. Great rhetoric. So if I sum it up, my next question, I believe, has already been answered. It was, if that's the issue, that we're ill-prepared for large fires, how can we effectively train and prepare for those events? And if I sum up what both of you guys basically are saying is mastering the basics. And to me, it sounds like we have to get to a position of unconscious competence where we're performing our basics without having to think about them. Like, and I'm taking that straight from what you said, Bob. And so, you know, when we look at stretching lines as a mundane process that we've already accomplished in our life because we got this minimum standard certification that says we can do it, well, the reason why we drill on it more and more is so that we can do it while sizing up a structure and making the next plan, almost like a quarterback is watching the defense react to the movements of his linemen and what receivers, and then throwing the ball before the receiver even gets to his slot. We want to be in that type of a state of mind. Is that pretty much summing up what we need to do to get better at these fires?
Oh, absolutely. You have to be able to do all those basic things without the thought process.
Right.
So if you're on the back of the rig and the officer says start a line, and he doesn't mean an IV, he wants a hand line, it should be a cause for concern for the people there. You should be anticipating that he's going to call for a line. You should be in position to do it. The nozzleman should be ready to go. Hey, start a line. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like we've done 800 times in training, start a line. Not rolling it, not wrapping around a tree, not drop the line, put a knot in it. It's just like you've been doing. It's still the base.
Go on, Bob. Go on.
No, I say it's still the basics. It's what's killing us is we're not good at the basics.
Right. It's like whether you want to talk about a big city fire department that has organized engines and ladders and squad companies, or you want to talk about a small volunteer fire department that the tones go off, the guys respond to the firehouse from home, it still should be the same. Again, it's circumstantial. I get that, okay? But the thing is, when you let's go for the small fire department where the guys have to come from home or whatever. When we take that engine apparatus, we equip it with the hose lines, the tools, the appliances, and things like that. Alarm comes in. Those firefighters jump on that apparatus. They should be functioning as an engine company when they get to the scene of that fire. Not doing going off and doing something totally unrelated to engine work. Especially if it's a first and second due engine at a bread and butter operation, because it goes right back to that getting water on the fire. If they don't do it, who does? And if they're confused about what do they do first, grab ladders and tools, or do they stretch a hose line? Again, it's a timing issue. The fire's burning in this wood frame structure, whether it's one, two, or three family or whatever, or if it's a one, two, or three story townhouse. Get the line going. It's just that simple. That's what we expect. And when those volunteers come from home and jump on the ladder truck, we would expect them to start truck work. We wouldn't expect them to run over the engine and grab hose lines, right, when truck work needs to be done.
It's discipline. You have to have discipline in your operations. You have to have discipline in your training. It's all based on the discipline. Now, New York City used to have a rule about the roof man. And it was nothing so to deter the roofman from getting to his position and getting the bulkhead door. It used to say nothing. People jumping out windows, you passing a victim, get the roof. That was what it was. It was the discipline of it. And now I'm not talking about whether they should be doing it now or not. I mean, that's a whole nother argument. But it's all about the discipline of your position. If this is what you're supposed to do, this is what you do on the fire ground.
Right.
You know, right. No one has a man breaking off to make a search because he thinks he put the fire out. No, we'll get someone to search. The nozzleman's a nozzleman for a reason.
Perfect.
Yep. Oh, yep.
Excellent. So we'll go back to the book and see what Chief Freed has to say. I'm going to move into a more specific chapter of Chief Freed's fire tactics. He starts talking about cellar fires. So just quick here. Probably more buildings are destroyed by fires that started in cellars than in any other place in a building. There are a number of reasons. The important ones are enumerated here. As a rule, the combustion process in cellars is slow. The lack of oxygen and draft effect. This creates huge amounts of smoke, making it difficult for firemen to advance to the fire area. Number two, discovery of such fires usually is delayed because the fire may be burning deep within the cellar. Number three, ventilation is limited. Number four, men going down into a cellar fire are in essence moving down into a chimney. Quite the opposite of moving in below a fast-moving fire with the heat and smoke moving up and away from the firemen. Number five, cellar fires usually require breathing masks. This limits free breathing and visibility. Number six, the application of water to the seat of the fire is frequently inefficient. What cannot be seen is difficult to hit. Number seven, it is difficult to determine whether the fire is moving up beyond the reach of the hose streams. Eight, the technique of handling such fires is not well understood. Number nine, a cellar fire exposes all floors above the cellar to the action of the combustion products, which fill upper floors rapidly. 10, it'll be necessary to ventilate and search the upper floors. Moving through here, number 11, this search procedure will demand the services of a good deal of your incoming manpower. It will delay your getting required hand lines into positions to combat the fire spread. And 12, the material stored in most cellars provides sufficient fuel for a hot fire. So I jumped a few of the items that Chief Fried had mentioned in there just to kind of keep us trucking along here, but I think we get the point. Bob, do you agree with Chief Fried's assessments of basement fires?
Absolutely. So there's several factors in it. There's stuff that we've mentioned already and we'll talk about more, I'm sure. But it's too hot, too dangerous, too smoky, too scared. You know, looking down them cellar steps, if you've never been in that position before, you better have that company officer that has been. You know, the other thing, and this is going to be the tangent part, but look at what we've done with our training. Look how we're not allowed to burn in buildings anymore. We can't have realistic fires in the quiet structure. There's states that it's outlawed. You know, so we go to gas-fired props, where as long as you throw enough water and you hit the little switch, the fire goes out. We use fake smoke. So, you know, we get people that leave the fire academy, and the first fire they go to is the first fire they go to.
Right.
You have unrealistic training, which results in unrealistic operations on the fire ground. So, again, you know, even a basement fire, there are several steps. If you look at the things that the chief says, there are still several things in there that are still our basics. Getting the line to the right position for entrance, ventilating the building to improve conditions to get down the stairs. But all of that, if there's still not a leader, if you still don't have a company over that's going, hey, come on, bring it over here. These are buildings that, you know, we're going to burn down. So pretty interesting. He says a cellar, not a basement.
Right, right.
The listeners right there. What's the difference between the two? You know, some people have no clue. Some jurisdictions have different meanings. You know, some are more than half below grade. Some are all below grades. You know, there's 100 definitions, but just the mention of a cellar fire to me means completely below grade. So limited ventilation. So now do we have to cut the first floor to get ventilation? But we're dealing with a very, very tricky fire. If we don't have the basics down pat for the other fires, the kitchen, the bedroom, the ground level fire, basement fires will continue to burn buildings down.
Right. This is a fire depending on the advancement of the fire. And I'm going to stick with like your 2.5 story frames right now. Older building, balloon frame construction. As Bob says, it's going to go up. The fire's going to go up the internal void space. It could go up the outside wall spaces. But I want to talk about the first line going in. You know, again, you know, so many guys, we try to make the push through the front door, find the basement stairs, go down there. And that could be a very tough thing. I mean, I know many firefighters have been crawling across the floor only to have, you know, oh my God, you know, this is hot as hell, you know, and my knees are starting to feel it and so forth. You get yourself a good fire right below you in a wood frame structure. And many guys have had that floor sag down a little bit, meaning it's starting to give way or the fire's starting to burn through and things like that. You'll know because you'll have zero visibility and the heat building up and so forth. So what do we do? Do we realize that maybe we have to find another way in? Some houses have a side door entrance, and that might be an alternative if you can't find the cellars or the basement stairs. In many cases, your basement stairs and your upper stairs going to the second floor of a house like this are generally stacked upon each other. So if you find the stairs to the second floor, generally get behind them, and a lot of times that's the door to the basement stairs going down that way. When it comes to your hose line layout, keep it straight. Keep it straight. This is a training issue that we talked about a little bit ago because, you know, I remember going into a basement fire one night. We went through the front door to the rear of the house, into the kitchen, down the stairs, and a young firefighter was with us, and I think he had pulled up 100 feet of line into the dining room, extra line. And I don't know where he thought we were going to go with it, but you see what I'm getting at here, okay? Keep the line straight. Hose line manageability, following the hose line in or out if necessary, or if you have a push-come-to-shove situation, you know, It's all about that. And that is a discipline that was mentioned earlier also, about these, especially these kinds of fires, you know, totally different from a fire budget.
So part of this cellar tactics portion that I brought it up specifically because basement fires seem to be an issue in my jurisdiction. And so training for them hasn't really, at least my training hasn't necessarily prepared me, in my opinion, for the actual fire ground. And recently, within about a year, I went to FDTN, took their live fire academy, where we did multiple different burns, right? And so one of those burns was basement fires. And it was a simple drill, live fire training nonetheless, but a simple drill of literally just moving a hand line down the stairs and button hooking towards the fire. And then we'd repeated it several times. That type of training doesn't seem to be the norm, at least in my experience in the fire service. And from what I'm hearing from both of you guys, that's exactly the type of training that can prepare us for this complex type of basement fire, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because one of the things that I was just going to chime in with is, you know, I focus a lot on the company officer. They're going to make some good decisions, some tough decisions sometimes. But crew assessment is pretty important. You know, you pull out the door and you look over your shoulder and you got the A-team, there's a lot of things you can do. If you pull out the door and you got the triple Z's sitting behind you, you still have to use the fire. But you might approach it differently due to the experience or lack of it, and the same with training. And occasionally, you have new people. My fire company in Delaware, Christiana, Delaware, just took on 18 new members. So we get pretty good coverage, and we get scattered groups of senior and junior. But they're very possible the next time I'm there, I might have four new people on the fire truck. Yep. Well, then it's going to change my vision of how we're going to operate, only because I know they don't have the experience of the crew I had the last time I was there. So, you know, you have to sense that. Career department, it's easy. In the morning, they show up. Oh, him? Oh, good. I'm good to go. The volunteer, the combination, it's a little tougher. You don't know on a day-to-day basis who you're going to have to be able to do the job that you're trying to attempt.
So, Jeff, I got a quick question for you. Just a little context before the question. Another reason I brought up basement fires for discussion was they've been some of our most difficult. And to be honest with you, like early in my career, we lost a structure because of a basement fire. It was in a taxpayer type of dwelling, type three construction. It started in the basement. However, we couldn't find the fire. The location was delayed, you know, actually finding the fire. And so hence we struggled with it. Well, fast forward 12 years, we had another taxpayer fire in my jurisdiction. And all of a sudden we had some issues with that fire as well. And, you know, it definitely caused the fire ground some concern for everybody's safety. So that being said, obviously it's the smoke banking down and filling that basement and then clouding our vision to get there and find where it's at. And then the heat coming up the chimney, delaying the hand line getting into position. What would you say are a couple of the either training cues or tactics we could use to more properly handle this fire from an engine perspective?
Well, number one, you're going into a basement, and solid ore should be the nozzle of choice. Because if we start pumping air in there through a fog stream, where does it go? You're already telling me, you know, this is a hot, heavy, smoky fire and so forth that's going to be very tough on us, especially going down the stairs. So proper nozzle of choice, heavy volume of water, as I said before, you know, take as much water in with you as you can. But the other thing is we're masking up together, not this thing about where a guy steps off the engine, you know, and he's already got his face piece on, he's ready to run off because he's all full of piss and vinegar, you know. No, we have to go on air together as a team, because we're going to be working this line in together as a team. And I'm taking that the scenario you're giving me is where the heavy smoke meets us at the door.
Yes.
So that line has to be bled, that pressure's got to be set, and we got to have that thing ready to go. The other thing is moving the line in as a team. Don't force the line in. You know, again, I've always used the example before. Take a two-story fire. You know, we come up the stairs. You're the nozzle man. And everybody behind you, they want to get a part of the action. They want to be a piece of it. And they're pushing to get up there. And what do you feel yourself doing? You've got two or three rooms burning in front of you. And these guys want to feel the heat and get up there in it, you know, and be with you. And you feel yourself being pushed in. This is the exact wrong thing. That's wrong anyhow, okay, in that situation. That's where the company officer has got to prevent that from happening, but especially in a basement fire. Because now in this case, that hose line is so much your lifeline when you start finding those or working your way around to find those steps, find those basement steps and get down there. Jesus God, you know, I mean, that's a tough situation that you're talking about right there. And, again, everything has to be, again, I say, the hose line should go in a straight line. Imagine a guy running low on air or push come to shove, whatever. Guys are following the line out. And then there's about 100 feet looped up in the, you know, whatever area of the building it is. You're running low on air. You want your butt out of there, and you're following this hose line, using up the rest of your air all along. So
perfect.
And I'm also going to. Yeah, but also the other thing. So we have the discipline of the attack hose line and so forth. And again, it gets right back to that ventilation ahead of us. You know how important it
That's
is.
That's what I'm going to ask you, Jeff. So yeah. what was on the first floor of the building? What type of occupancy?
All right.
It could have been a grocery store.
So it was a liquor store. In the fire that I was on, the second fire I referenced, I actually wasn't on the fire ground. I just talked to the men who were working on that fire ground and heard some of the similar problems that I experienced in a previous fire. So I just correlated, hey, we're not really fine tuning our basement fire, especially in commercial dwellings at this point. But the fire that I was on, yeah, we stretched in, and the first level was a liquor store.
So my first good fire in New York City, I was a fireman in 255 engine. And 6:30 in the morning of my first night tour, we roll around the corner and we had a bank on fire. They had broken into the bank looking for money, couldn't find any money, they lit the place on fire. So it's chugging out of this place everywhere, out the front door, it's right to the floor. Make a long story short, I'm the backup. We start moving in the front door, and every inch of glass in that building disappears. Hmm. It was a corner store. The trucks got every plate glass window. Guess what happened after they got every plate glass window?
You can see.
From not being able to see the sidewalk, to being able to see the entire back of the bank on fire. Yeah. And we were able to move in and extinguish the fire. The reason I bring that up is a lot of times, because of either inexperience or not understanding the process of getting to a fire, a basement fire in a store, I'm taking the plate glass windows right away. Why am I doing that? I'm trying to enhance getting the line to the basement stairs.
All
right. If I don't take those plate glass windows, all the energy that comes up those stairs has to go where? Out that front door. If something goes wrong, where does all that energy have to go? Out that front door. We're letting the fires control the buildings. Get the building open, give the engine a shot to get into position, and they might actually save one. And that's why I was asking, did you go look at that building? Were the plate glass windows still intact? Or did they finally break because the fire broke them hours later?
I didn't get a chance to look at it, but I absolutely understand your tactic. You're coordinating the fire ground, and this seems to be a very misunderstood term, and you know, that fire ground coordination. It almost seems like our ventilation practices happen not almost in sequence. Like first we have to put out the fire, then we can ventilate, versus this is a condition that dictates the tactic. We can't even get to the fire. We talked about it earlier. So now we need to ventilate prior to suppression, which I believe is misunderstood, because I believe what everybody thinks. If you start opening up the structure before you have a fire control, people believe that some catastrophic event is going to happen, which it could. But that's why you actually, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that's why you have the charged hose line with the troops that are in the greatest danger, is once you start ventilating, they have the cure. And now you can actually start coordinating and allowing them to get in proper position. Am I on the right path here, guys?
We are depending on those truck guys to get that joint open up for us. Absolutely. Look, it's not a thing about, being cool or being brave or being, whatever it is. No, we're doing a job that, could go south very quickly here. Okay. The other thing is, and I got to say this because it's happened too many cases where the nozzle man, because of his basic training, because this is what it falls back on when things go bad. It comes back to your basic training. If he has been taught not to open the nozzle until he sees fire, you're talking about a commercial place. You're talking about a place that's got combustible stock and a whole lot of it, and a building that's going to lend itself to the fire also, as Bob said. Okay? So why would we take that chance of having a nozzle man who doesn't know when to open up the nozzle, cool that environment, or prevent it? And again, I'm relying on the truck guys or hoping these guys get this joint to just open right up, make it explode, if you want to call it that, you know?
Copy that.
We've lost sight of the types of ventilation. And I don't mean mechanical, positive pressure, but the reasons why. We vent for fire or we vent for life. Two completely different things. Venting for life, VES, knowing that, getting into a bedroom before they have water because of, time of day or information that there's someone in there, comes with the risk that knowing that the fire knows I'm giving it air. Venting for fire is, no, we're venting to get the engine to the seat of the fire. We know it's going to be bigger. But I always said, so listen, we pull into this place, it's a store, we don't take the windows. What happens eventually to that fire? The fire gets them, the fire makes the windows fail 2 hours later, and we burn the place to the ground anyway. You know, that still picture I referenced before I saw on the internet last night. An engine company bogged down on the front steps with fire out one window on the exposure four or D side. They can't get off the steps. So what do they need? They got a line, they're flowing water. They can't see. They can't overcome the heat. They need help to get in 15 feet to find the entranceway to that room. So ventilation. And again, oh, well, no, we don't want to break the windows. Well, no, we do. We don't want to do a lot of things, but we do want to, and that's venting for the fire. Maybe we should call it venting for the engine instead of venting for fire, and people won't be so afraid to do it.
Great points. Okay. All right. So we're going to move into some engine company specific rhetoric by Chief Freed. And so, Jeff, you're going to be getting some good questions here. Obviously, Bob, chime in where necessary. But back to Chief Freed. And this actually touches on something that Jeff has already mentioned. Do we have valid reasons for placing hose lines in certain positions, or are we really guessing? Unfortunately, in many cases, we do just that, guess. Is the term science of firefighting justified? Is our job a science or one of skill and judgment based on practice and constant observation? A science is exact. Results should not vary from time to time. The very word science connotes precision. Is our job such? I think not. If our job is one of great skill, why cannot we serve some form of apprenticeship, learn it well, so that firefighting becomes largely a matter of applying what we have learned? Actually, this is partially the way we do train our men. Is there then a general procedure to follow at major fires? If so, this procedure can be applied to all fires. It would be helpful if the answer was simple and constant. The difficulty, again, is the lack of similarity in fires because fires are different. They require adjustment of techniques to deal with the problems at each particular fire. So, Jeff, do we have valid reasons for our positioning our hand lines, or are we just guessing?
No, we do have valid reasons, for positioning of our handlines. Absolutely. You know, it goes back to our incident priorities and, you know, life safety, incident stabilization, property conservation. That's supposed to be priority order. But we have fires where we have to get the line in service to protect those lives. In other words, we're taking incident stabilization ahead of life safety at that point. And that's key in that type of situation. Locate, confine, extinguish. Okay? Locate the fire, confine it to as small an area as you can, kill it, extinguish it, go in and kill it, you know? And these are other things that we use for determining where hose lines are supposed to be laid to and operated from.
Perfect.
God, I mean, I'd like to think it's kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Simple, basic, principled in its approach and so forth.
You don't want it to be as hard as some people seem to want to make it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
So, when I was reading through that particular part of the book, I started understanding, you know, what wasn't necessarily built in me as an officer was choosing where to position my hand lines via priority. And actually Chief Reed later in the book goes on and gives us many different scenarios. If this, then position here. If that, then position there. And it's based on, like you said, Jeff, a lot of the incident priorities in a certain manner, and even the conditions that you have on arrival. It's obviously size up and things of this nature, but he breaks it down very well later on, and we'll discuss that a little bit more later. But quick question on this end, and this question I've always enjoyed having or giving the senior men this question, because I think everybody has a different view on it, but we'll go with it. So how many rooms of fire does an 1¾-inch hand line actually handle?
All of them.
Right. So
eventually, yeah.
Right. But I mean, you know, so the context is, you know, if I'm a new company officer, when do I make the bump up decision on, let's just stick with a single family dwelling here. You know, is it 2-3 rooms? Where am I going to, you know, because obviously you're not going to make your NFA fire critical flow rate calculation right in front of the fire. You got to have that instinct.
Some people might, rather than do the job of getting the hose line out, getting water in the fire, they just might think about, oh, how much do I need to flow here first? Process for those guys. Anyways, you know, that's an interesting thing to bring up, because I know there was a training book out there that talked about the 1¾-inch should be able to handle 2-3 rooms of fire. You know what? It doesn't go to the next step and say, however, based on fire load, construction, internal problems or situations and things like that, size of the rooms. And when you say how many rooms, are we talking about a 10x12 bedroom? Or are we talking about 12x15, 15x12 dining room connected to a equal size living room? You're talking about, if those things are completely involved and I got fire coming out of three sides, I better get a good flow going. And that comes down to that attack line, that 1¾-inch line. Bob, Mike Lombardo, and I, you know, we were out of Portland again talking about, you know, size of tips and so forth like this. And if you're asking me about 1¾, there is no less size when we're talking solid board than the 15/16. And we're talking about a bread and butter fire here. You need it for the extinguishing power. You need it for your own ability to make yourself safe and to protect anybody else in there. It's just like that. I'm trying to simplify here, but that's it. So what's the size of the rooms? What's the fuel load? What's the construction? You know, the advanced state and things like that. Is the structure itself now burning? So
it's a dynamic.
Positioning that hose line to get the biggest bang for the buck, you know, and again, keeping incident priorities in mind if you can.
So it's dynamic.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Perfect.
I'll make 2 cents in, if I may.
Yes, sir.
Sure.
I've said for years the biggest problem in the American fire service is we have no idea what's coming out of our fire nozzles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're starting to get away from the variable flow, variable pressure nozzles finally, but introducing them how many years ago took our engine operator out of the equation. And New York City used to have the FT2 tip, they called it. It operated between 65 and 105 pounds pressure. At 65 pounds, the spring would activate, shape the water that was there into the stream. The more pressure, the spring would act, would change the orifice. So the stream basically looked the same at 65 or at 105. So the pump operator didn't even have to pay attention anymore. Luckily for us, they did, because they were used to having to figure out friction loss. But now with presets and automatic nozzles, different hoses, you know, there's been some studies done on nozzles that have shown that departments underpump all the time, and then with nozzle problems, have no idea what kind of water they're getting. So you want to think about, you know, how many rooms of fire. If you use any of those, National Fire Academy, NFPA, whoever else is doing their flows, they almost say you can put out a whole first floor of a house with an inch and three quarter line. It's within the fire flow requirements. So my thing is, how much water? So if I know I'm getting 184 gallons of water a minute, or 183 or 185, you know, give or take a gallon here or there, and I have three rooms of fire on the first floor of a house, and I have a good firefighter on the nozzle, to me, that's doable. Now, you start throwing any of the variables in, that's when we start to run into our issues. So to me, knowing again that basic setup, getting 185 at the tip, having a nozzle man train, having a good company officer, having a truck that's opening up to get us that access, I'll get a shot at a lot of fire with that. To try to quantify it and say, well, this nozzle is good for two rooms, this one's good for 2.5 rooms, you know, we're going to do ourselves a disservice by trying to pigeonhole us again.
Right.
But
right.
The right amount of water, train your people to advanced lines. You know, we do a simple drill. We start three steps down on the second floor, and our firefighters open the nozzle and have to get up and make the turn and advance through the second floor without shutting the line down.
Excellent.
But that gives them that ability to knock down the overhead for a fire that's coming out of two bedrooms and rolling down the length of the hallway. If they can't get up off the stairs, water never gets into the fire rooms. So I would look at it that way. How good are my people? How good is my pump operator? How good is our procedures? That's going to determine whether I can put out that whole first floor of that house.
And so just a quick summary on this topic for me, listening to the senior men here, would be, as a company officer, as a department, as a chief, as your leadership in a department, then it becomes valid that, again, training the basics are going to allow you to understand the factors to build that instinct and make decisions. And those factors were just mentioned here. So that's, it's good. All right. So moving forward. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Let me throw something else in there. Okay.
Yep.
Jerry Herbst, you know, an old friend of ours, you know, he's done a lot of work over the time with many fire departments, and he always makes a statement: the fire service pumps for comfort, not for effect. And he's right on the money. And that's how we get into this thing about, well, let's go with a little bit smaller tip size. It's less reaction force. You know, it'll be easier for the guys to handle. You know, I like Bobby's idea of the drill that they do, you know. Get that nozzle flowing. You got a serious fire ahead of you. And really, you know, when you're talking about a house, think about your house. You know, it's a confined area. It's not wide open. You know, you got a hallway that's, what, 40 inches, 44 inches wide or something like that, 5 foot wide, 5 by 6. And then the bedrooms, you know, you don't have a lot of area to work in. So you got to have that biggest bang for the buck again, you know, to get the job done ahead of you without it blowing back on you. And that's the thing about volume, okay? It's gallons per minute that puts the fire out. It's just as simple as that. So.
Yeah.
I have a great...
Go ahead, Bob.
I have a great...
I wanted to say, you know, the fire service has been pretty progressive in that. Going back to what Freeze's comment was about, you know, booster lines and so forth. You know, he even talks about it in there about, you know, we've seen inch and half. We've gone to inch and three quarter. You know, we've looked at different size hose lines. And again, the nozzle hardware. We can put the water in the hose, but if the nozzles are working against us, like, you know, in so many cases, the automatic nozzles work against our flow. And because, again, if it's too much for a guy to handle on the nozzle and he's not getting backup support from the other members of his attack team, what's he going to yell out? Cut the pressure down. You know, I can't, you know, and that's going to take away gallons per minute. That's another thing, you know. So it's a teamwork approach from the engine company perspective. Okay.
No, that's great. Did you have something else, Bob?
I was just going to say, I have a video that I use from here in Montgomery, New York. And it's an interesting video. It shows us pretty much on arrival. And we have fire out five windows of an old downtown house. And I stopped the video and I asked the audience, how's this work in your place now? You know, what's going to happen? Got fire out five windows. You know, we're a small department. We don't go to a lot of fires. And I asked them, you know, do we burn the roof off this place? How long does it take us to put it out? Do we hit it from outside? You know, I start the video again. Luckily, we had had some pump problems. So we know when we get water. Because you see the pump operator come back down. We had a top-mounted pumper at the time. And he comes back down. So we know he's now giving us water. And it's a minute and 8 seconds, and it's all gone. The fire is out. And we pride ourselves in that. And I said, it's not magic. It's pumping 185 gallons of water a minute. It's teaching people to be able to move with the line open. And it's someone there to say, no, come on, let's go. And that's what it was. That nozzle man hasn't been to 500 fires. I don't think he's had the nozzle for more than five in his life. But the ability to have all the other pieces in place gives you that ability to move up and knock down a fire like that.
Now, see, that's a team approach.
And, you know, I'm just going to piggyback on something Jeff said earlier about, you know, Jerry Herbst, who, you know, I know Jeff's been doing a lot of work with him on Know Your Flow and traveling, and that's part of their training curriculum, and it's great. We need to get to this stage in the fire service. It's in the military. You know, they train the troops from day one, know what type of firepower you have from a single weapon. I mean, they train you on your weapon ad nauseum, where you're taking apart that thing blindfolded and put it back together. You know your weapon. And we don't really have that in the fire service. At least it didn't happen in my indoctrination. And then you mentioned that they pump to flow. They pump to comfort instead of for flow, which is actually effectiveness. And so that's something I've just gotten so sick of, is the actual, like, we do things to comfort. And I don't think we fully understand what impact that's actually having on our fire grounds when we start taking that mental approach. You know, I go to different trainings, instructing, and classes for new firefighters, and or even for veteran ones, you know, just ongoing drill. And the structure of the class is, let's make sure the guys are comfortable. It is at every step of the road. Like, if I bring up a drill, let's say, like, hey, let's actually charge the lines, move them through, and do a basement drill. Well, they're going to get all wet. They're going to get all sweaty. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's how we do them justice. Because guess what? When they get on the fire ground, you think anything's comfortable when you're on the front lines? It's not. And so the only way, what I learned from the military, to actually feel like you're in a comfort zone so you can effectively do your job and focus on what's in front of you, is to be inoculated by that environment before you get there. You know, through your training. And yeah, so anyways, sorry, that was just something that,
oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it just seems like that comfort issue. Yeah, that comfort issue is overcoming parts of our fire service, and hopefully we can make a small push on that as we keep, you know, progressing.
Say, did these people coming into the job know that you can get injured or even killed in this job, or were they expecting it to be like a day on the beach when you go to a fire?
Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. All right, so speaking the front lines, I figured this next section would spur some good conversation. And it starts out back to Freed. Advantages of inside streams. Far too many fires extend without the man in charge becoming aware of such extensions, because too many fires are fought from the outside. There are certain definite advantages to the use of inside streams as opposed to outside streams. Here are some of them. The nozzleman sees where his stream is aimed and whether he is hitting fire. 2. He shuts down as soon as the fire is darkened. Thus, there is less water damage. And since he hit fire and not smoke, the smoke is not wet and remains more buoyant so that it lifts readily. Otherwise, it is difficult to ventilate the building. 3. The nozzleman can carry the pattern of his fog stream because he sees the needs of such variants. 4. The fire is being attacked where it should be, at its seat, not at just flame tongues and smoke. 5. The nozzleman is in position to judge the path of the fire in any extension. For example, the fire may be getting out through a rear window and into an adjoining building or a drop ceiling. It may show that fire has entered the ceiling space, indicating the need for shifting lines or for additional lines. And 6, the nozzleman may come across an unconscious or trapped victim while he is operating in the building. He can cover the victim with a line until help arrives. So, modern fire service. This is the big issue that's at our forefront. And I think actually number 6 shifts to number 1 on our focus to the mission personally. You know, all the rest of that is obviously relevant, but I think the fact that a lot of our victims are found in paths of egress and we need to put the line in between the fire and the victim has been lost by some of this other knowledge that's out there. What, Jeff, what do you got to say on this?
Where do I begin? This goes right back to incident priorities and having to take the incident priorities out of order to satisfy the most important one, which is life safety. Get the line working. And as you are working your way into the seat of the fire, if you do come across that victim, that's good. Okay, we got that guy taken care of. You think you're going to get in there that deep without your protective hose line, you know, and the conditions deteriorate. Now we not only have potential victims, and we don't know if and where they're at. The other thing is we have firefighters who are in trouble also. So we can put ourselves in these positions, you know, just by not taking the line, being aggressive with it, and going after the fire.
Bob, what do you think? No.
It's, you know, all the questions are real good, but we keep coming full circle.
Right.
Well, we do. I mean, what are what we're trying to accomplish? What does it incur? What do we have to be able to do? We have to get our line in operation. The line has things that it has to be: correct pressure, correct length, correct flow. You know, what does the truck have to do? The truck has to control the building for the engine. So the questions are all different, you know, based on what the chief said in his book. But we're circling the same issues no matter how we approach them. And I think the more we look at that, the better off we are.
Okay. So at the end of the day, one of my questions was, should we discard the empirical evidence laid out by Chief Freed regarding interior attack impetus? The importance of the interior attack, it seems like we are easily discarding at times and in different places the benefit of interior attack. The risk benefit maybe is a better term.
Well, what makes the risk?
Yeah. Are we talking about a rut?
The risk is part of what we do is being not prepared to do it. I can't change the fire. Turn the corner, it's out a couple of windows. The risk is there. It's a fire. You know, this risk a lot to save a lot, risk a little, save a little. What's the middle? Oh, this is a one-arm, one-leg fire. I'll risk that for this. You know, it doesn't make sense. I know what they're trying to say, but every time we go out, we risk everything we have. So I look at risk a little different than a lot of people. If I don't have staffing, equipment, all the other things that I need, you know, good company officers, if I don't have them in place, then I'm increasing the risk of going to that fire because I'm not prepared to go to it. know, you turn the corner and you got fire out of the window, that really shouldn't be the riskiest thing that we do that day. You're a firefighter. Your training should have you set to be able to go to that fire. Is there going to be some risk? Absolutely. The building's on fire. But we should make it riskier by not being prepared to go do that. You know, and as far as the interior fire attack, we've let this whole UL NIST slices thing overtake what we did. And it actually started earlier than that. Transitional attack. What is a transitional attack? Well, we hit it from out here and then we go in. Well, if you hit it from outside and you don't go in, what is it really called? Defensive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It wasn't transitional. You didn't go anywhere. Well, what if we're inside and the fire gets away from us and we get driven out? Well, I guess that's transitional then too, right? We went from offensive to defensive. So you're either in or you're out. You might be trying to accomplish things to get in, but if it doesn't work, you're defensive. So hitting it from the outside is defensive. It's not transitional. That's a made-up term that somebody wanted to do to get their name on a magazine article.
Excellent. Well said.
Mm. Because if you're not in, you're out. You're defensive. If you're in, you're offensive. You're interior. You're exterior. Call them what you want. But, you know, this whole thing to come up with a whole new way of attack, no, it's always been there. We've always done that. If I can't get in the front door, I'm hitting it from the outside. I'm defensive. Hey, look, we got nothing knocked down. Let's go. Now we're offensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can switch modes. Yeah. We should go aggressive until we cannot do it. And again, let's talk about the bread and butter operation. Okay. You pull up, you know, you got fire coming out, you know, heavy fire. What does it take to get that line up to the door, get the door opened up, and get the line in position and start playing away from the vestibule or the hallway? You're getting a line inside. You're getting it. And if it takes effect, and this is where people got to watch the fire. Are we getting steam coming out? That means we're getting water and fire. Okay? Keep the nozzle open. It was said earlier a little bit ago about guys hit the fire. As soon as the flames darken down, they shut down, which is the wrong thing to do. We can be more aggressive, and we can be more controlled. Nobody from our circle or from our perspective is saying we're out there to recklessly fight a fire. That's a bunch of bull, you know? We're talking about good, aggressive, measured, methodical firefighting, however you want to say it, but that's what we should be doing. And again, you have to assume there's risk involved in the job. So if we can get that line in that door and see the benefits of it, good, then we continue on, okay? If something happens that blows down on us or whatever the case may be, then we back up a step and regroup. So does that sound logical?
Absolutely. And sometimes I almost feel as if we adjust our tactics based, again, on that comfort level. Have we drilled with purpose, and have we drilled with a hardiness that will develop a firefighter who's adaptable and skilled to be able to handle tough firefighters? And since maybe we haven't, well, then let's find some safer approaches, because we failed in the first mission, and that's preparation.
Right. And again, I'm going to go back. That's your basic training. Your basic training has failed you when the nozzle man doesn't know when to open the nozzle. You know, again, they're running around in a smoke-filled steel or concrete building and so forth, you know, and it's easy in that case. It's not the real world, as Bob said earlier. And the other thing is the instructors that we have there. When I hear some of the ways guys are taught to take a line into a fire area, I cringe, because all I can think about, here's a disaster in the making right here. The other thing is when the fire training instructor, because of their experience level or lack of whatever or however you want to say it, is getting burned, then how are they at teaching firefighters how to attack the fire and keep themselves from getting burned?
Hmm.
I never liked getting burned when I was on the job.
How one of the fun things we do.
What's that?
I said it wasn't one of the fun things we all got to do.
No.
All right. So
let me throw in there. We've let the science become the new thing. And, you know, the science is good. They've done some great studies. They've given us a lot of information. But a lot of their ideas is stuff that we've always known. They've just given it titles. And now, and, you know, we talked about slices a little bit. Listen, if that's what your department's capable of, then that's what you're going to do. But to me, the first line from the outside to reset a fire shouldn't have to be unless you can't get inside. You know, that was always an option too. But if I'm properly trained and I have the people in the building at my best interest, I'm getting a line to the inside of the building if I can. Yeah. And what they're doing is they're trying to make one size fits all. And that's, again, all the way back to, you know, New York City not getting the bulkhead now. Well, when they do some fire studies in six-story, eight-story buildings on the Grand Concourse, I guess we'll see if that works or not. Well, but the burnout house, it's going to react the same way. It's silly.
Right.
So.
And we're so concerned about firefighter safety from the administrative, from the chief officer standpoint. Without giving up the principles and practices, why aren't we looking at higher flow nozzles? Again, go back to the inch and three-quarter line with a solid bore. You know, like I said, I'm concerned about this. We'll let firefighters take a lesser amount of water in than they should, and then we'll cry, oh, the fire's too much. Oh, we have to get guys out of the building. We've got to keep guys off the roof. We can't do this. It's like, well, we're setting ourselves up to fail with that mentality. And that doesn't do good for the people that we're supposed to protect or the buildings that we're supposed to save. Make the push. Make the effort. Be aggressive until you can't, and then we go to plan B. But you got to equip the guys and train the guys.
Copy that. All right. So back to Chief Freed. Just a note on exposures, because this was something I'd learned at a later stage in my career that I wish I would have known earlier. So exposures. There are three kinds of exposures to consider at fires. Life, internal, and external. Life. One, hazard to occupants by flame spread either in the fire building or in adjacent or adjoining buildings. Two, hazard to occupants from dangerous fumes or gases. We'll keep pumping forward. Three, hazard to firemen who would have to operate in precarious positions. And then four, hazard to spectators from falling walls and explosions or both. And then he goes on to describe internal fire exposures. This is the exposure the fire building offers to itself by the way of one of the following routes: burning through floors or walls, unprotected horizontal openings, and unprotected vertical openings. Also, fire lapping out of a window, conduction, building collapse, things of that nature. And we all know external exposures. To me and my indoctrination, it seemed like the only exposure that we ever talked about was the external exposure. And it gave me a new concept, but a new understanding of the RECLVS tactical priority acronym. So regarding exposures, does the vast majority of our service see exposures as only an exterior-based problem? Do you guys think that?
Yeah. Most fire departments are engine operation-oriented fire departments. If you have a fire service that has staffed truck companies that look to perform truck work, opening up the floor above was always part of the drill. You always check for extension on the floor above, because in the buildings that those places went to fires in, you always had it. You know, Jeff mentioned earlier, balloon frame house. If you have fire in the basement of a balloon frame house, guess where else you're going to have fire? Everywhere. So if you're not smart enough to get to the first floor and go, oh, yeah, it's on its way, you're not smart enough to get a line started for the attic, you're not expecting to find fire in the attic, then you're not paying attention to the program. So it has always been six exposures, right? All four sides, above and below. I mean, it's always been that way. Jeff, you ever go to an attic fire in a balloon frame house and have it drop down into the basement?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah. And people don't believe that can happen.
Yeah, and how many times do we have it happen before we go, all right, this is getting to be a habit? You know, I mean, so you have to have someone thinking that way. But unfortunately, again, now we're into the staffing issues with all the reasons why in the American Fire Service, you need people thinking about the truck perspective, whether it's for the search, whether it's for the ventilation, whether it's for the extension.
Right.
If all you have is engine-orientated people, then they don't worry about the exposures.
Right. There's six sides to every fire you go to. And I don't, you know, when we're talking about buildings, you know, whether it's a ranch house, a two-story, three-story, whatever, there's six sides to a fire. And Bobby's right on. You know, as soon as we on the nozzle get that fire knocked down, we hope to have somebody in there pulling the ceilings, opening up the walls, and opening it up for exposure. That gives us an idea. I got to say something anybody who's on a nozzle in a fire. That if your fire department's the kind where the guys are, once that nozzle knocks down that fire, we got guys entering that building from other areas. You know, it might be ladders from the back of the building or coming in behind your nozzle, going up the stairs or whatever. Nozzle man, keep in mind, you've got to make sure that fire's controlled the best of your ability, because you got guys, and their exposures also. You have the internal voids, which are now allowing the other areas of the building to carry fire to them, but you've got guys committed to that building also. And this is why fire attacks and visuals and communication are so important in this situation I think you're talking about.
All right. So we're about 5 minutes out here from Bob. I know you got to get going. So I think what we're going to do at this point is make a part two to this show. We'll just call this part one on fire ground tactics. And we'll do the second part when time allows. Regardless, do you guys have any other final comments on some of the subjects that we've approached here?
Bob? Well, the biggest thing to me, and I've said this a long time, is you have to be a student of the game. You know, you can't treat this as a part-time profession. I've been doing it a long time. I'm still trying to learn. I'm still looking for people that have an insight. I look for things that I'm not doing that can make what I do better or a different approach. You know what? I may not agree with you all in this and slices and dices and whatever, you know, Vegematic we're using this week, but I read them, I understand them, because if I'm going to react to them either positively or negatively, I have to have the information. So I do study that stuff, and I do try to find correlations between what I've always done and what they want me to do. And that's one of the reasons I am comfortable and still doing what I've pretty much always done. I've seen the information, but none of it is anything that's going to make me turn around and say, oh, hold on, I'm going to stop doing this because this is a much better option. So I study this stuff. I recommend everybody does. I'm sure Jeff is the same way. You know, after 45 years, every day I still do something in the fire service. I'm reading something. I'm watching a video online. I'm down to firehouses. You know, so I'm still part of it, because when you stop, you stop.
What do you think, Jeff?
Oh, you know, I try to come from the principled background. I think I said that earlier also. And again, even Freed talked about the modern fire service in his book, which was published back in 1972, the modern fire service. And I see that or hear that from a lot of people today, younger people who are saying, well, we have to have a modern fire service. No, we don't. We got to get back to the principles and practices of this job, and that's what it's all about. Look, if there's a house on fire, throw a bunch of water at it, get it under control. Now let's add the other things to it, you know, like the engine work, the truck work, the search work, and stuff like that. But never, ever get away from the basics of the job, and that's what we're doing. We're looking for black and white, in print. If it's not there, I don't know it exists, or I've never been trained on it type of world right now. And again, to me, firefighting, it's circumstantial, it's also geographical, and it's also local conditions. So.
Perfect.
But I love what you started here, and when we do this again, we're gonna just continue on.
Absolutely. So I'll just put some things into conclusion, because I've been listening and I've been trying to take notes while also moving forward with questions. But some of the notes I took from this episode, one of them that I loved was the riskiest part of our job is not being prepared to do it. That's great insight. Another one you just mentioned it a minute ago. Firefighting is circumstantial. Firefighting is an art, and officers are confused. And so, how do we start to confront those issues by mastering the basics? You start putting in those known inputs through drill, and all of a sudden they become habit, which is instinct on the fire ground at the end of the day. Some other great things that were mentioned in this episode: discipline in operations and training. It does take disciplines to get your ass out of the station and start doing some drill. And then that discipline will follow you on the fire ground. So great stuff, guys. So at the end of the day, I do want to take a minute here to thank Fire Engineering for this opportunity to
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah.
Let me one quick thing in there, because with everything you just said, a couple of years ago at one of the, get-togethers where all the leaders of the fire service sit down and decide our future, it pretty up in that atmosphere of firefighter made the statement that experience doesn't matter anymore because science will take over for it. And, out of all the things I hear and see from people, that's one of the things that kind of pissed me off, because experience does matter. Because knowledge without the experience is only theory.
There you go.
You read the book and it says, oh, wow, that's good. Well, if you don't go out and put it into perspective or try it, then it's just a guess still. And I think, experience is what makes it all come together. And that's also been kind of bashed by the fire service. So it goes all hand in hand what we're talking about, but until you take that nozzle and go out and flow it and go, well, that don't work the way they said. If you read about it and you read the brochure, well, that's great. Yeah, but it doesn't work that way. Or it works that way, you only have a specific pressure. Well, that saw will cut through everything. Well, no, it won't. I mean, you have to have the experience with it, whether it's you experience it in training or actually do it on the fire ground, for it to really matter, for it to sink home and be able to be used.
Yep. Let me build on that if I can.
Absolutely.
Your thing about experience, look, we can never, ever let that cry bring us down because of the experience that we went through, the experience that we gained over our years of doing the job. And I tell people, that's like seniority, okay? You protect seniority because that's your time in the job. You know what you did. You know what you experienced. You know what you learned. And another thing about experience, it's our firefighting history and experience that we look back upon to base on how we're going to do the game now. Again, firefighting isn't a science to me. We use principles and practices and so forth. They worked then. They will work now if we work to get the disciplines and the procedures back. But we have to have that in place. And a few other things, I'm sure. So
what it sounds No, what it sounds like you're telling me, Jeff and Bob, is that to a degree, you have to exhibit some humility to continue to develop your experience, not only through engagement on the fire ground, but on the drill ground as well, if you want to become a complete firefighter, one that enhances his safety factor when he goes into operational mode. That humility will lead to, again, the discipline we mentioned earlier, regardless of time you have on the job, to enhance your safety and operations, basically.
This is a time-honored profession. You don't just come in the job and say, I'm ready to fight a fire. I know it needs to be done. I read it all in a book in fire training school. No. We cannot let that supersede time in the business, okay? You learn this job over time. You learn it from your senior people. You learn it from the good officers. You learn things from the bad officers too, but nevertheless, you learn things all along, okay? So I'll hold off here. You're getting off time.
Any final comment, Bob?
Nope, that's it. I'm good to go.
All right, so to finish off our show, we're going to thank Fire Engineering for giving us a platform to engage with the fire service, specifically Chief Halton. And finally, find us on Facebook. We're going to establish the Senior Man Facebook page. Give us some of your questions and commentary so we can bring them up as we have our next future episodes. We can bring it up to the guys, our senior men who are investing in us. They've put their time in, and they're still investing in us, and I'm humbled to be a part of that. So thank you for listening to our show, and we'll wrap it up and see you next time.